Broward County will have a police review board, but what powers will it have to create change? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Commissioners approved the board last week, but faced some opposition.
You're not creating a review board. You're creating a lynch mob.
We'll learn more about the powers the board will have to punish officers, reform departments, and improve police training. Also, did the Trump campaign use voter data in 2016 to deter voters from showing up to the polls? We'll look at that and how misinformation continues to spread in this election. Finally, a group of students at the University of Miami claim that the school used facial recognition technology to target protesters. The school denies it. We'll hear from one of the protesters. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. The spread of misinformation about the presidential candidates is making its way through social media channels, text messages, and on television and radio. In Florida, there have been reports of voter intimidation through email and unverified stories that have been spread on Twitter, WhatsApp, and Facebook. A recent investigation from the Miami Herald found the Trump campaign in 2016 directly targeted black voters in Miami-Dade with false stories about Hillary Clinton. How could misinformation be impacting voting in Florida, one of the critical swing states, in this election? Well, joining us now is political science professor at the University of Florida, Dan Smith. Dan, great to have you.
Nice to be with you, Luis.
So one of the primary issues that came out of the 2016 presidential campaign was the spread of targeted misinformation about the candidates on social media. To what extent have we seen that problem unfold in 2020? Is it anything like 2016?
Right. This question of the micro-targeting was fairly unprecedented in 2016. Massive data trove that the Trump campaign was drawing on and working with the firm Cambridge Analytica was taking thousands of fields of data coming from commercial data houses, but also from the public available voter file, to micro-target specific ads, Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram, and on YouTube. And these efforts were designed in a way that really we haven't seen prior to that time at that micro level. It's going on again in 2020. There's no doubt about it.
So you reviewed the Miami Herald investigation of this social media campaign targeting specifically black voters in Miami-Dade. And again, it was targeting them with misinformation about Hillary Clinton. It was described as a process of deterrence. Can you explain how deterrence works as a strategy in a campaign?
Sure. There are different efforts to try to win an election. One common way is to expand the electorate. So certainly Barack Obama's campaign in 2008 was all about getting voters who had been on the sidelines to register to vote and turn out to vote. That's expanding the electorate. There's persuasion about trying to get people who are undecided about an election and about candidates to vote in favor of that individual over the other candidate who is running. And then, of course, there is an effort that the Trump campaign used as deterrence. And deterrence is an idea that you're not really interested in persuading these people, and you're certainly not interested in turning them out to vote. You want them to stay home. And so that's what the Project Alamo, this project of campaign, Trump campaign and Cambridge Analytica was already trying to do, was identifying individuals who they were not going to be able to have support Trump, but try to get them dissuaded from supporting Hillary Clinton and turning out to vote.
So the Trump campaign denies that, you know, this was a deliberate attempt to target black voters. But from the investigation, what does it tell us about, you know, the demographics of the accounts and the neighborhoods that were targeted? Who were they going after specifically?
Right. So this was a nationwide database that the Trump campaign had put together of millions of voters, including the voters in Florida at the time, around 14 million, registered voters. And some of the categories that they had used their artificial intelligence to drill down and figure out through these thousands of fields that they had information about to classify individuals. So it would take all this information about past vote history, about what you were saying on Facebook or what you were watching on YouTube to try to determine whether or not you were going to be a core Clinton supporter or a core Trump supporter. And for those folks, basically, why waste your money? You're not going to be able to persuade them one way or the other. They're either going to support Hillary Clinton or they're going to support Donald Trump in 2016. But then they had these other categories that their algorithms created, such as whether or not they should try to get the vote out for some Trump supporters who clearly have some liking Donald Trump, but were not great at turning out to vote themselves. And so how do you mobilize them? Or how do you persuade some swing voters who may have supported Obama in 2008 but stayed home in 2012 and get them to go? But then there were these categories such as disengage Clinton and deterrent, which were Clinton supporters who were unlikely to vote, make sure that they didn't turn out, these disengaged Clinton supporters, but also the deterrents and those ones who we could demotivate from voting at all. And these were very targeted. The Trump campaign in the Miami area focused really along precincts along the I-95 corridor, going from north to south. And these have historically been black communities. There are certainly a lot of different racial ethnic groups in them. But effectively targeting these areas and then targeting at the micro level. This was not just sending out letters to households. This was actually drilling down and sending specific messages to those residents in those precincts.
Because
strong support for Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, as you said, I mean, they broke it down to all these different groups. And as we know, with algorithms on social media, you could target very specific people. How do we know the strategy worked? Can we say it actually worked?
Well, yeah, that's a great question. And that's one of the things that the Miami Herald, working with Channel 4 in Britain, and I helped provide some of the data on turnout, of whether or not this actually worked. And so since this is at the individual level, these identities, we can actually match up and look at these individuals and whether they did turn out to vote in the 2016 general election. And what the Miami Herald's research team was able to do was show that, yes, indeed, black turnout was lower in 2016 than 2012. That makes perfect sense, especially in a place like Miami-Dade. You don't have this statewide black candidate on the ballot, Barack Obama, as he did in 2012. But the real question is, was black turnout lower among those categories that the Trump campaign was trying to suppress the vote?
Yeah.
Deterrence and disengaged. And that's what they found. They found that actually black turnout was lower, but it was even lower among these categories.
So, you know, now what we're seeing is this spread of misinformation from places like, for example, QAnon in Spanish language radio, Facebook feeds, WhatsApp, and targeting Latino groups in South Florida. Do we have a sense whether these stories are having an impact on voters here, Latino voters specifically?
Luis, that's a really, really good question. I have a lot of my students at the University of Florida who are from South Florida, and so they're hearing a lot of this. They're seeing a lot of this disinformation. One of my students who graduated from the University of Florida in 2019 got one of those email addresses, supposedly from the Proud Boys, saying, "We know who you are, and if you don't change your registration to Republican, we're coming after you."
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's a pretty overt attack in terms of trying to suppress the vote or change the vote. But it's the more subtle ones in terms of the Spanish language media that are being used. We're seeing this strategy almost that, you know, black voters are a tough ask for the Trump campaign in 2020. And so now they're focusing on divisions within the Latino community in South Florida. And so we're hearing this with respect to stories focusing on Cuban emigres who have naturalized, going back to not only the folks who came in the 1950s, 1960s, but the recent emigres.
Yeah.
Looking at divisions in the Colombian and Venezuelan communities and looking at socialism micro-targeting. So, it's not a new strategy, but it's one that can have effectiveness if if the information is not out there to
right.
correct that.
And that email you're talking about with the the Proud Boys, that's it reports had already come out that those were coming from Iran. Again, I'm talking with the University of Florida political science professor Dan Smith. We're a week from the November general election, and again, misinformation among voters in Florida remains a big concern. You could read the Miami Herald's investigation into the disinformation campaign targeting black voters in 2016. Just go to our social media at WLRN Sundial. Dan, what are we seeing in terms of voter turnout in Florida so far this year relative to past years? Because you kept mentioning how each presidential election compared to the other.
Yeah, I mean, so 2016 black turnout specifically in South Florida was down. You can just see it clearly across various precincts. That said, among, for instance, the Haitian American community in 2016, even though turnout was down, support was very strong for Hillary Clinton. But because turnout was not as high, that helped Trump in terms of that predominantly blue county now, notwithstanding a strong Republican Cuban-American tradition there. But what we're seeing now is a shift in terms of practical strategy. The Democrats have been pushing, as we know, vote by mail, and we're seeing vote by mail ballots coming in record numbers. The real question is whether or not these are people who would have voted anyway on election day or early in person. And, the evidence is somewhat mixed. I'm looking here at data from this morning, and if you look at people who didn't vote in 2016 who have already cast their ballot, there are almost 80,000 African-Americans who have voted who did not vote in 2016
so
who voted early in person.
It's
21%.
Have we heard from voters at the exit polls about the reasons leading them to the ballot box this year compared to 4 years ago?
There's not any exit polling yet, but there are certainly some polling going on. A lot of people are obviously concerned about the coronavirus. And one of the interesting areas where the Trump campaign is having its most difficulty is with older voters, including white voters, including Hispanic voters, who are concerned about their health or their family's health. And so that's polling data that comes nationally, but I get a poll this summer with my current students and former students where we had 12,000 registered Florida voters, and we could see quite clearly the support for Trump, which is fairly strong among white and certainly strong among Republicans, starts to decline, especially among older no-party affiliates, as their concerns over coronavirus goes up. So I think that's one of the areas that we're definitely seeing people's excitement about turning out because of the current condition.
Something, though, I wanted to look into is that there are reports that thousands of mail-in ballots have already been rejected. Is there enough time for voters to rectify the problems before November 3rd?
Yeah, so this is an area that I've been focusing on for years, and I think finally there's some attention going on about the thousands of ballots that come in, including, there are about 2,500 ballots in Miami-Dade that right now will be rejected unless voters cure them. They have until 46 hours after a close of polls on election night. But what is going on is we're seeing an increased number of voters voting by mail. Younger voters disproportionately more likely to make mistakes with their signature, or missing signature, or mismatched signature. But we're having a higher cure rate than we've had in the past. And that's because the supervisors of elections and these groups and the parties on the ground are reaching out to these voters. So right now there's about 15,000 ballots across the state that are going to be rejected unless voters cure them. But again, I'm more optimistic in the past that these ones coming in time are going to be cured than in the past. The big issue, though, is ballots that are coming in that are going to be rejected because they come in after Election Day.
Yeah. And again, they have to have them by 7 p.m. on Election Day. Not postmarked, but they have to have them. One thing I want to finish with you is this. I wondered what similarities and what differences do you see this year compared to 2016 or even the 2000 presidential election in Florida?
Well, I think the biggest irony potentially is that we may see very long lines in heavily Republican areas. Because of the president's messaging against vote by mail, we do have tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of voters who are either canceling the vote by mail ballot or have already shifted to voting early in person. There are still hundreds of thousands of Republicans who are going to wait until Election Day to cast their ballot. And they are going to be seeing longer lines than they've ever seen before, because many of these voters who usually have gotten their voting out of the way early in person or most noticeably by vote by mail are going to be waiting in line on Election Day.
It's a week from today, and again, we'll mention we may not have results that night, so hold on tight. We'll see. I've been speaking with the University of Florida political science professor Dan Smith. Dan, such a pleasure. Thank you for the insight.
Always great to be on WLRN.
All right. And again, if you want to know more about where to turn in your ballot, where you can vote, you know, mail-in voting, or if you want to check on your ballot because you sent it in, and you want to, you could follow it. You could follow it like you do a UPS package. Just go to WLRN.org, find out how, and track your ballot. Well, still to come, Broward and Miami-Dade have new boards for reviewing police misconduct. But what powers do they have to enforce change? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Following months of protests in South Florida against police brutality, Miami-Dade and Broward County have approved new boards that are intended to hold law enforcement accountable. In Dade, commissioners voted to approve in August a civilian review board to investigate complaints of officer misconduct brought forth by the public. Last week, commissioners in Broward approved the Police and Criminal Justice Review Board. It'll track problem-prone officers and weigh in on policies within the Sheriff's Department and local law enforcement agencies across the county. The commission unanimously approved the board, but some local politicians did raise opposition. The new Florida majority was in support of the measure and will be sitting on the board. Their political director, Dwight Bullard, joins us now. And we should note, Bullard is also a Democrat and a member of the Florida House of Representatives, formerly a member of the Florida Senate. Mr. Bullard, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So Broward County now has a police oversight review board. There was a hard push after the protests from the summer to create more of these, you know, in different communities. Why does Broward County need one?
Broward County needs one. I think the remaining 65 counties need one as well. This is something that is not just a reaction to the murder of George Floyd or to any of the other individuals who've illuminated this summer. This is something that's needed to be around for quite some time. So I appreciate the unanimous consent that the Broward County Board of Commissioners chose to be proactive, in my mind, in covering a number of bases that that Miami-Dade kind of fell short on, actually, in their passage of a civilian review board. And what I appreciate about Broward was it covers the county as a whole, including non-sheriff police agencies.
And look, these review boards are not new. I mean, Miami had one for some time, but what's different now?
Well, I mean, the time and place is naturally the urgency and necessity is what created the need for these boards at this moment. You're right. Miami-Dade did have it. It was defunded by the previous mayor, and then chosen not to be enacted by the current mayor, even though he had the discretion to do so. But again, step forward in the right direction. As Commissioner Jordan, who's on the Miami-Dade County Commission, chose to kind of make this something that became a priority for her as she's getting ready to leave the board. And it's also supported by one of the mayoral candidates as a co-sponsor. And so for that reason, I'm thankful that they took a step in the right direction. But of course, it does not have the subpoena power that.
Yeah. And Mayor Jimenez twice pushed and said he'd veto it before he finally accepted what they put forward.
Exactly. And that was the crux, was the fact that the initial ordinance did require subpoena power. And he vetoed that because of that. And once that portion was eliminated, he allowed it to go into law.
All right. Tell me the two or three, and I know there's many, but tell me the two or three big problems in policing in Broward that you hope this new board will be able to address?
Well, my hope is that it would just really reinforce the need for critical reform, internal reform within these police agencies. Right? So now that you know that there's a transparent, community-centered board that will address these issues of brutality or misconduct, that would now signal to these agencies that enough is enough. We really have to do an internal check and balance on how our officers are being trained, how they're interacting with community, and what they're saying and doing.
But what is that
in these communities?
Give me a specific though. Is it police training? Is it police tactics? Is it what exactly?
Well, it definitely is training in terms of implicit bias, you know, cultural competence, the failure for these officers to truly connect with communities, especially communities of color, and especially within that, the Black community as a whole, I think is critically important. The tactics, absolutely. We're seeing a ban on chokeholds. We're seeing a ban on some of these more nefarious tactics that agencies have used in the past. And de-escalation, I mean, that's critical. We saw what happened in Philadelphia just, yesterday or 2 days ago, where the gentleman was, again, you had somebody dealing with mental health issues, their parents out there asking the police, please don't shoot this man. He wasn't rushing the police and yet and still was shot 10 times by a police officer. So, you know, those kinds of incidents are really what was at the root of many of these marches that we saw happening this summer, was people basically saying, please stop shooting me, and find a new way to deal with these issues.
So the board is made up of 24 members, and you could go to WLRN.org and you can look at the story to see all the different agencies and groups in the community that are on this board. The new Florida majority, of course, is on there. You're on there. How do you see this massive panel of people coming together to deal with these issues?
Well, really, I mean, the initial proposal called for a smaller board, but I think the presence of community and such a wide-ranging perspective of folks is important to have. It's important to have because you want a cross-section of the community to truly be represented. You didn't want it to be overly politicized by being too small and thus falling into the hands of being appointed positions, you know, and going into that whole political gamesmanship atmosphere. So I really do appreciate the thought behind it.
And you had some, there was pushback on this. Hillsborough Beach Mayor Deb Tarrant was concerned and called this group, quote, a lynch mob.
Yeah, that was very disappointing to hear that from an elected official, especially in this current context, and especially understanding the history of what a lynch mob actually is, as opposed to the hyperbole she was trying to use in the description of this board.
Did you approach her about that?
Because it was virtual, I did chime in because I spoke after her on that day. I had to share my thoughts that I really found it despicable, the idea that you would invoke the term lynch mob for a board that's just there for oversight.
All right, let's look at what this board can and cannot do. This board cannot investigate specific complaints, but what can it do?
Well, what it can do is offer community, and I really do think this is one of the more important pieces, offer community an outlet when misconduct happens, right? I think the current process we know does not work, which is like this internal review, not transparent, doesn't involve community, is absent of that. So what the review board aspires to do is just that, create a situation in which someone can now offer up a complaint, know that it's going before a board of community residents and folks who can then offer up suggestions on what the next steps are. Now, the thing about it is that the reality of the state of Florida is that the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights does prohibit certain steps, but what we're hoping that this board can do is begin to offer recommendations, meaning that if an officer needs more training, offer up that recommendation. An officer should be, let go or put on desk duty, offer up those kind of recommendations.
But those are recommendations. Those are recommendations. What about the, isn't the idea of these boards supposed to be accountability? Is that enough?
Well, it should be, but we also have to recognize that there are laws that were already in place that predate this review board that put limitations on what a review board can do and the strength that the review board has. So, if we look at gold standards in other states like Washington State and others that have more punitive review boards, sure, I would love to get to that so that folks who are victimized have a greater sense of redress.
All right.
However, until we get there, this is a good starting place.
And I'd have to look at those to see exactly what they do that we don't do. Again, I'm talking with Dwight Bullard, political director for the New Florida Majority, joining us via Skype. The New Florida Majority will hold one of the 24 seats on Broward's new Police and Criminal Justice Review Board. You can learn more about the review board from our reporter, Katie Swatalski, by going to our social media, WLRN Sundial. So we heard from Sheriff Gregory Tony that he wishes he could get rid of bad deputies. He's also in support of the board, saying in a written statement, quote, "I fully support the implementation of the Police and Criminal Justice Review Board. It's easy to support accountability and transparency. That's why I was the first law enforcement administrator in the county to endorse its development." But then you have the union, and they're probably going to protect a lot of their officers. What can this board do about officers or deputies that have a history of brutality, complaints of use of force, or anything else, and then the union's protecting them? What could you do?
Well, we oftentimes talk about the court of public opinion when we're talking about social media or the news or anything else. So the fact that there is an actual board, set up in law in Broward County that says this officer has gone overboard, crossed too many lines for too many times, it would be very difficult then for a policing agency like the Broward County Sheriff to look at a comprehensive review of what this officer's done and still kind of maintain the normalcy of retaining that officer. So what I encourage folks to understand about this is it does not work if people don't come forward, right? Because a lot of times individuals have filed these paper complaints at the Broward Sheriff's Office. They don't know where that goes. There isn't a lot of follow-up. In this occasion, they would actually have a follow-through.
There's a process.
They would know exactly.
All right.
Where they stand.
You're the political director for the New Florida Majority, and I wanted to know to what extent in your outreach with voters that criminal justice issues and police brutality rank high in getting, to the polls this year. Is that the case? Do you see that?
Oddly enough, just this past Sunday, we had a conversation with black male voters and just asked, anecdotal kind of question. What is police brutality? What is criminal justice reform rank on a scale of 1 to 5? Overwhelmingly, those gentlemen said 5. And that they said that was 5 as in a motivating factor for them to get friends and family out to the polls. 5 as in a motivating factor for them voting themselves. The makeup of the group were black men, but these are black men that were professionals. These are black men that do not have a felony record, not to say that having a felony record should in any way lead to some sense of brutality or make you any different. But I say that to say that universally, it's problematic when a group of people, in this case, black men, universally have had negative run-ins with law enforcement. That reinforces the fact that there needs to be systemic change in terms of how they approach these things. And so, yes, it is definitely a motivating factor for families and communities to get out there and vote. And moreover, they feel that the passage of these kinds of boards are political wins in a world where you oftentimes feel deflated by some of the things you see happening coming out of D.C. or Tallahassee.
Dwight Bullard, political director for the new Florida majority. They will hold one of the 24 seats on Broward's new Police and Criminal Justice Review Board. And you can learn more about that review board. Our reporter Katie Swatolsky has been doing the reporting. It's on our social media at WLRN Sundial. This is a story we're going to keep following. Mr. Bullard, I really appreciate the time.
Thank you so much.
All right, still to come. Has the University of Miami used facial recognition technology on student protesters? A look at the debate over privacy on college campuses up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Students and workers at the University of Miami are accusing the campus's police department of using facial recognition to identify student protesters. The university has denied those allegations. Students and faculty and subcontracted workers staged a mass die-in protest after the school decided to reopen for in-person classes back in August. Weeks later, some of the student protesters were called in for a meeting with university officials that left them wondering, how were they identified? Mars Fernandez is a grad student and research assistant at the University of Miami, and she joins us now. Mars, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
And also, we're waiting to get a hold of David Uberti. He is a cyber reporter, and he's been following the story for the Wall Street Journal. I believe we don't have him yet, but we'll try to get him up here as soon as possible. We did reach out, by the way, to the University of Miami Dean of Students to join us for this conversation. Instead, they provided a statement, which we will read throughout the conversation. And again, we will post it online at WLRN.org. So, Mars, let me start with this. You were at this die-in protest. This was back September 4th. First of all, what does a die-in protest look like?
Sure. So a die-in protest symbolizes how we felt our university was demonstrating a lack of consideration for our well-being. And what it looks like is a bunch of people laying on the ground, some of them holding tombstones made of cardboard with messages pertaining to their specific concerns.
How many people were there that day?
We think probably between 20 and 30 people were participating in the die-in, and another similar amount of people had come to as an audience to come support.
And just at where on the campus or where, what area were you in?
Sure. We were at the UC University Rock, which is a courtyard and a designated cruise beach zone on campus where people typically raise similar concerns around social justice.
I believe that we do have David Uberti with us now, again, a cyber reporter following the story with the Wall Street Journal. David, you reported that the dean of students asked campus police to identify students who were at the protest and then called them to a Zoom meeting. What did the dean say about what his intentions were for calling that meeting in the first place?
For university officials who I got in touch with last week, the meeting was strictly informational. Basically wanted to go over with students the proper protocols for organizing an event on campus. They were essentially asking them to fill out the proper paperwork to reserve the right space and alert university officials that were actually holding this event. Per what university officials tell me, this is in no way a disciplinary meeting of any kind. This was just strictly a chit-chat between students involved in the protest in the dean of students about how to organize events like this in the future.
So again, the university did not join us. Nobody from the university joined us for this conversation. They did send us a statement they shared with us, which says this, quote, "As part of our efforts to ensure the health and safety of our community, especially during this pandemic, university administrators met with students who failed to follow the appropriate process when organizing an in-person event." That's the statement from the University of Miami. Mars, did you follow the process?
Well, I was an organizer of the event, and protests are often just spontaneous grassroots reactions to unjust conditions. And I believe I've since learned that there's a 4-day waiting period. And I know that there are like free speech organizations, civil liberty organizations who are concerned with the policies at UM specifically related to needing to reserve a space in order to express our concerns.
And what was talked, what was discussed at that Zoom meeting? You know, what did you hear from the university?
Sure. What I heard was that our dean wanted to hold a meeting to review the procedures of protest and not the content of our protest. Ironically, this was our first time being having any sort of meeting around our shared community concerns since the beginning of the pandemic, where numerous groups on campus representing faculty, students, staff, grad students, and subcontracted workers have tried to meet with the university leadership, escalating from letters to petitions to statements, and finally bubbling up into a in-person, very quiet expression of concern.
So
in that,
And one of the interesting things about this is the fact that, again, they called specific students to this meeting, and this is what led you to believe, well, wait a minute, how did they pick us? Are they using facial recognition to find us? Is that did that come up in the meeting ever?
It did, exactly. That was our primary concern. After we received the email and everyone was really nervous about what this conversation would be about, the next question we had was, how were we identified? We did not know each other prior, and now we're all connected, which I think is wonderful. But of those 9 students, the question of what kind of surveillance technology was used to identify us emerged. So that was a question we asked in that meeting. And eventually what we learned was that what we heard from the dean was that this is facial recognition software was used to identify us, whether he misspoke or not, I'm not sure. But then he went on to share a story of a case of a misidentification of a student, which we know that facial recognition technology misidentifies people of color, non-binary people, feminine people. And so that misidentification can lead to really horrific experiences.
Yes.
So that's why we need a ban on the use of this technology.
And just to point out, 20 different human rights organizations have signed a letter to the university expressing the concern of the use of that technology. David, what's the response from the university? Were they using facial recognition?
So on a number of occasions when I put this question to them, the university vociferously denied that they were using facial recognition, both in this specific circumstance and doing so generally. You know, university officials say that in some specific criminal investigation, UMPD will go to the Florida Department of Law Enforcement to run a photo of a potential suspect through that organization's database of arrest photos. But they were pretty adamant in the argument that they were not using facial recognition in this specific circumstance. Now, that said, you know, a number of university spokespeople told me that basic investigative techniques were used to identify students such as Mars and some of the other protesters that were there that day.
And
they
wouldn't
elaborate what exactly basic investigative techniques mean, whether that involved surveillance cameras of some sort, maybe manually analyzing that sort of data. Furthermore, Dean of Students Ryan Holmes has not responded multiple requests to me on whether he misspoke or what the sort of crossing of wires here might be that students would infer that he was meaning facial recognition software, which, you know, as I'm saying it right now, it doesn't exactly roll off the tongue.
And the other thing, too, just wondering, did they ever use social media to look up people?
Different law enforcement organizations have used social media in the past to do that. That is certainly the case. But, you know, as I said, you know, just now, the university wasn't elaborating on those quote-unquote basic investigative techniques they used.
Okay. And Mars, you wanted to say something, Mars.
Yeah, I don't have too much information on that other than checking Instagram students was mentioned in the meeting we were a part of. But from what I can tell, there was very little advertisement of this die-in via public social media presence.
Again, I'm talking with Mars Fernandez, grad student and research assistant at the University of Miami. Also joining us, David Uberti. He is a cyber reporter for the Wall Street Journal. And again, we're looking at this story about a group of UM students who were at a protest back in September. And some of those students were called into a meeting with the dean. And those students claim the university might be using facial recognition technology to spot them. The university, again, denies it. David, the chief of the campus police department made some changes to his resume since the incident. Why and what were the changes?
Well, on Thursday night, if you look at the resume listed for David Rivera on the university website, he basically outlines how the University of Miami campus includes a system of 1,338 surveillance cameras recording 24 hours a day. And it goes on to say that they use sophisticated algorithms which detect predefined situations and parameters such as, and I'm quoting here, motion detection, facial recognition, object detection, and much more. Now, those are pretty common things that, you know, you would say if you were using facial recognition software. And the following morning, when I went back to the same website, downloaded a new version of Chief Rivera's resume, the mention of facial recognition and motion detection were scrubbed from that part of his resume. I asked university officials about this, about what's up with the discrepancy in the timing of this, and they said that Chief Rivera was merely updating his resume to scrub details that weren't exactly accurate. They claim that those 1,338 cameras on campus are merely capable of using facial recognition software, not that they have any software actively deployed on them at the moment.
So what do we know about this facial recognition software and how widely it's used, on college campuses, you know, around the country, David?
Well, there's many different types of software. There's several companies that produce this sort of stuff, and the range of uses can really run the gamut. They can be fairly mundane. I'm talking hypothetically here of, you know, students trying to get into their dorms or their libraries, maybe buying food from the cafeteria. Facial recognition could potentially speed up those processes. Then if you're talking more in terms of law enforcement surveillance, you could also have, you know, campus police or local police departments that are tapping into, you know, surveillance camera systems to basically run those photos of students through artificial intelligence-based software that identifies their facial features.
Let me come back to this. We know how many cameras are on campus. We probably know where most of them are. We know what they can do. We know that they have the ability to do facial recognition, right?
They certainly have the capability. The question is whether they're actually being used for that.
Okay. Mars, how is the communication right now between, you know, you, the other protesters, and university officials?
We haven't received any response to any of our concerns or emerging demands around surveillance.
And I'm wondering, I mean, at this point, you know, have you tried to have any conversations about how the university is basically watching you?
Yes, we've been delivering numerous emails President Julio Frank, asking him to hold an open forum related to specifically how we were identified and also to make clear what the university surveillance practices are in general. But we have not received word back on whether he's willing to hold that space.
Mm. So we did hear from another UM student, Esteban Wood. He is a senior studying political science. He was also at the protest and is one of the students who was identified. Let's take
it's had a chilling effect on members and even future members. And it's not just this facial recognition piece. Some protesters felt that the dean's presence at the protest was intimidating. Some thought that campus police officers showing up was unnerving. But the fact that we were surveilled, tracked down, and called in made it so that the main message received was, we're watching you. But what if instead it was, we hear you? Or at least let's address the issues at hand.
Mars, do you think this is going to have an effect on the students, the workers, other members of the university who might want to protest in the future?
I think people are concerned to what level the university can use our data and through our Wi-Fi connections, through tracking us through facial recognition or these predictive behavioral algorithms to sort of in the blink of an eye take it all away from us. So I do think that it is causing people to think twice. But on the other hand, I think that people are becoming more organized and concerned with this issue, and specifically how it relates to protest and dissent on campus. And so I think that it's also activating people.
How will it affect you, though, if there's another protest organized at some point in the future for whatever issue? You know, will you think twice before going?
The university has said that only people who organize protests have to abide by the registration requirements. And so as long as attendees go in good faith and are just responding to something they hear about, then I don't think that this will change my level of engagement at UN.
David, this story has gotten national attention. I'm wondering what kind of response is it getting from privacy advocates, from lawmakers?
Right. I mean, as you mentioned earlier in the segment, 20 civil liberties groups and privacy groups sent a letter, open letter today, basically protesting the University of Miami's mixed messages on this. In addition, Rashida Tlaib, who's progressive lawmaker from Michigan, tweeted the other day about how facial recognition technology has no place on campus, in her estimation. So, you know, we've seen this in a number of cases with facial recognition where you have certain incidents in a specific town or a specific campus that blows up onto the national stage. But it is emblematic of this larger discussion taking place between law enforcement agencies and businesses on one hand, who see some pretty useful aspects of this technology to help them do their day-to-day work. And on the other hand, the people who are actually being identified with this work, whether accurately or inaccurately, raising questions about the specter of surveillance or the possibility that they might be misidentified just based on the color of their skin.
And, you know, I mean, look, this is a national debate. This is a global debate, because we see this happening in countries all over the place. But this question of the using facial recognition, and as you said, there's some organizations and agencies that'll tell you there's some advantages to that, but isn't this just where we're at going anyway? Is it we're just going to end up there anyway?
I mean, a lot of the technology is pointing in this direction. There have been a number of studies that have raised really serious questions about facial recognition, including from the federal government, saying that certain types of this software do misidentify people of color at a disproportionate rate. But the companies that are making this software are also refining it, which isn't to say that, you know, the accuracy problems can't be rectified. But I think if you were to ask advocates about what their sort of base concerns are, it's more so the specter of surveillance and sort of the reliance on these sorts of AI-based technologies in surveillance, with the potential for inaccuracy to be something of a side effect of that broader problem.
Yeah. Mars, let me finish with you at this point. What do you want from the university? What are you asking of the officials?
Yeah, thanks for that. It's so interesting how a student organization gets called in into the facial recognition debate because of their commitments to labor justice on campus. But what this has surfaced is that the university is unwilling to clarify its stance, unwilling to take a stand against facial recognition, and leaving the door open to its use.
Yeah.
For whatever reason. So what we're really needing is that the University of Miami joins with all of those other universities that are saying that they won't use this technology against their community members.
Yeah.
And to meet with us for once about our pandemic concerns,
yep.
Specifically my organization is interested in subcontracted workers
and
concerns on campus.
Mm-hmm. And I have to stop it there because of time. Mars Fernandez, again, grad student, research assistant at the University of Miami. We also heard from David Uberti, cyber reporter for the Wall Street Journal. I really appreciate both your times. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And again, just a note, the University of Miami denied the use of facial recognition technology. The option still stands for an official to join us on the program to talk about it. We do have their statement on the website. Well, that's our program for this Tuesday, October 27th. Coming up tomorrow on the show, what are the key congressional races to follow in this election? University of South Florida political science emeritus professor Susan McManus joins us. Plus, for so many of us, the sensation of touch is critical. Think about it. The pandemic has impacted our ability just to touch another human being. We hear from the head of the UM Touch Institute about what it means to lose that connection. All of that coming up tomorrow on the show. Again, find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks again for listening. Stay safe. Be good to each other. We'll talk to you tomorrow.